And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. It's our monthly gardening show. We'll be taking your calls and your emails for the next hour. So what's on your mind? If you've got questions, comments, advice for what's going on in your part of the region right now as it relates to gardens, trees, flowers, pests, plants, more, join us. 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. Our experts joining us today are Campbell County Extension Office Agent Sarah Embus. Sarah, welcome back to our show.
Glad to be here.
And Hamilton County Extension Office Agent Joe Boggs. Joe, welcome back to you also.
Glad to be here, as always.
Well, we're so glad to have you again. 513-419-7100 is the number to call to join us. Or email talk at wvxu.org. One question I want to ask the audience, if you want to email your answers, is what candy are you most looking forward to swiping from your kids' baskets this weekend after they retire from a busy Halloween evening? Sarah, I think you and I will be looking forward to the same candy. Is that right?
Yeah, and I went to a grocery store recently trying to find them, and I still cannot find them. So I'm getting very upset about whoever makes the peanut butter kisses.
Yes, and for those who don't know the actual name of this candy, it's a very controversial Halloween candy. It's that candy that's wrapped in the orange and black paper, and they're called peanut butter kisses. And I have to say, Sarah, it's a good thing they're wrapped in paper, because if they just came loose, I would, my mouth would just be by the handful. I would eat this candy. And let me ask you, Joe, what candy are you looking forward to sneaking from the kids?
Malted milk balls.
Oh, good.
I love those. Oh, man. Crunch them up and put them in a milkshake.
Yes.
Or have a milkshake and them. I mean, just the whole thing.
That's a great call. Love that very much. But listen, it's also pumpkin season. And so maybe people are waiting till this last weekend to carve up their pumpkins, because they don't last that long once they've been cut up. So let's get some advice on a couple of things. First, we're going to talk about pumpkins to carve, what we should be looking for, and then pumpkins to eat, what we should be looking for. Sarah, starting with you, if we're out looking for a pumpkin to chop up and make something beautiful out of, what type of quality are we looking for?
Well, you mean like chopping up like a
cutting into a jack-o'-lantern. I should have been a little more specific there, not just losing your mind and chopping it up in a fit of madness.
Wearing a hockey mask.
Oh, man. So a few things. You know, I've been talking to some of our farmers, and there's been some delay with some of our vine crops like watermelon and some pumpkins this year. There was quite a bit of early flooding and a lot of rain. So hopefully you found a pumpkin thus far. I've been seeing them out at market and our local grocery store. So that should be all well and dandy. You want to get one that has no bruises, they are soft spots, and also any places that may have had any kind of injury. I've been noticing some that is in are in those large bins, you know, that may have some, incisions in them, if you will. They're, you know, because they will start rotting quickly. So if you haven't done so already, 2 or 3 days before Halloween, you want to go ahead and carve them, because if you did those like a week, 2 weeks ago, but even 3 weeks ago when I started seeing the pumpkins, they're probably already starting to rot. So just be careful and mindful of that. But there's all different colors, shapes, and sizes, some that have bumps, some that are white. You know, there's all different kinds. I love them. They're always really fun. So happy pumpkin hunting.
Indeed. And not just carving pumpkins this time of year. It is the time where we are eating pumpkin pie. And so, Joe, when we're out looking for something that we might want to use in the kitchen in a different way, what type of pumpkin should we be looking for?
Well, actually, I mean, you can use any pumpkin, but something that's very helpful is you know, the kind of the flesh to size ratio. So the bigger pumpkins that make great jack-o'-lanterns. Oh, by the way, Sarah, I actually like it when they start collapsing in on themselves. That really gives the, I mean, you can't create that, you know, a little fungal growth on the outside, you know. But now we're talking about food. That was a very bad segue. But but typically smaller pumpkins, and we see those on sale, and the intent being, okay, they can make small jack-o'-lanterns, but typically the smaller pumpkins are the so-called pie pumpkins. because when you open them up, there's a lot of flesh inside. As I said, and Sarah's reminded us both of this, you can, you know, make pumpkin pies out of any pumpkin, but your efforts are better rewarded if you can cut that pumpkin and you have a pretty thick inside to work with. And, you know, from my taste, you know, the canned pumpkin is pretty good, actually. I think that we'd all agree on that. It's easy to use. But the nice thing about doing it yourself is you can really try some different things. You're not married to the spices that are in the can. So, yeah, I would urge if you're a little bit adventurous with food, and you might want to try a little different approach to pumpkin pie. Like we were all talking before we came on about a sweetener that can really, from my taste, bounce up a pumpkin pie, and that is to use the sweetener partially molasses. It really gives a very different flavor profile. Oh, and now I'm drooling all over myself.
I know, me too.
So I apologize.
I was really hungry reading the emails when we were planning the show. And speaking of that, Sarah, we're not just talking about pumpkin pie. I mean, that comes to mind first, but there are other mm-hmm. things out there. We're going to put some links that you helped us find at WVXU.org inside the Cincinnati mm-hmm. Edition tab about this show. And, I mean, we're talking about pumpkin bread, pumpkin apple muffins, chocolate pumpkin, snack cake. I mean, there's a lot of ways to use pumpkin.
Absolutely. And not just in baking, but also cooking. So last night I made a butternut squash. So all those types so good. And I just cut it in half and I bake it and put a little honey and cinnamon. And it's so good. It's so simple. So similar to that, you can cut up a pumpkin. And it is so good. Of course, take out the seeds. I love baking the seeds and eating those. And those can last for a while. Simply putting them on a baking sheet with a little kosher salt and sometimes a little other flavoring as well. That's a nice snack. But you could grill pumpkin just like any other squash, zucchini type. And it just adds that wonderful, one, it smells amazing in your kitchen. And then secondly, there's a lot of nutritional value in pumpkin. You know, if you're putting stickers or painting a pumpkin or anything like that, you're not carving into a pumpkin, or you just have extras laying around, don't let them, you know, go to waste, because remember, they can store very well, store long periods of time if kept dry. You can eat them. So they are very delicious and very simple to do. You will need a sharp knife, of course. But with our extension office, both at the Ohio State Extension and Kentucky Extension, we have tons of information of how to cook healthy and different recipes. So myself and Joe and our co-workers at Extension would be glad to help out with that.
Very cool. Now, as you can imagine, as always, the phone lines are blowing up. The emails are coming in because people love this monthly gardening show. 513-419-7100 is the number to call to join us. Jeff is on the line first. Hi, Jeff. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thanks. My wife and I started growing habanero peppers this year for the first time, and we were really disappointed with the amount of peppers that we were producing in the summertime. Now that it's starting to cool down, we're getting a lot of fruit, and I didn't know if that was normal for this region for them to be producing peppers into November.
Interesting. Jeff, I'll place you on hold, and we'll turn to our panel here. We're talking about habanero peppers producing fruit in the winter. Is that something that's normal? Is that something Joe or Sarah can help us with?
You want to take it, Sarah, or you want,
Sure, I can start, and of course, Joe, fill in. But, you know, a lot of our Solanaceae crops, which are tomatoes, peppers, and eggplant, they are one of many of our summer crops, though they're not very easy to grow in the fact that they're kind of a little fussy when temperatures get out of whack, too hot, too dry. They really like that happy medium of like 75, 80 degrees. And so when we start getting those high temperatures and humidity, they stop producing flowers a lot of times. Other things can happen as well. And kind of fertilization, fertility, and moisture levels. But we see that quite often. We will get a later bloom and fruit set once the temperatures start to cool off. So that's one reason. Environmental definitely plays a factor in chew fruit production. Joe?
Yeah, I'd say the same thing. I think that really does. It can, as you're saying, Sarah, play havoc, you know, with fruit development through the season. On the other hand, it is very often surprising how some of these peppers that we're starting to see that have a hotter profile, it's somewhat surprising how late in the season they do produce. And it is, it kind of reminds us, of course, you know, peppers aren't native to the upper Midwest. You know, they're not native to Kentucky or Ohio. And so where they're native to has, you know, entirely different environmental conditions. So with habaneros, for example, I used to love to grow those and always counted on having peppers very, very late in the season. But here's another little trick. If you really like peppers and you'd like to keep them going, you can dig those plants up carefully and you can pot them, and peppers will go on and on and on. In New Mexico, for example, there are pepper plantations where the peppers look like trees because they don't necessarily need to die out at the end of the season as we think of them doing. So if you bring peppers inside, you know, like one plant, bring it in, pot it up, bring it in, put it in good light as best you can, then you can take that outside next year and you'll find that production happens a bit earlier. That's a kind of a trick that that I'm seeing some of the pepper aficionados do, so they can have hot peppers a little earlier in the season.
Well, there you go, Jeff. I hope that was helpful for you.
Barry, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. We appreciate it. 513-419-7100. Donna is up next. Hi, Donna. What's your question or comment?
Hi.
Hi. Oh, yes, can you hear me? We sure can. Okay. Go right ahead.
Yeah. I want to know what is the best way to cover, protect plants when there's a frost or a freeze, the material to use and how you drape it, whether you touch it and tuck or you try to suspend it over the plants.
Okay, Donna, we'll place you on hold and turn back to our panel. We've got Sarah Embus from the Campbell County Extension Office and Joe Boggs from the Hamilton County Extension Office. Joe, do you want to start?
Yeah, it's best to cover with as material that is as light as possible, meaning that you don't want to have a real heavy material laying on the plants, because if you do have, remember what we're trying to do here is we're trying to protect those plants from kind of localized freezing of the cells. And if you have those leaves right up against a covering material, you can still get some damage right there. Plus, if you don't get it off early, don't get the covering off early in the morning, you can also have problems with moisture accumulation that can lead to other things. So it is truly best to have some way that you can elevate, you know, the covering off of the plant. It's best to use as light a material as possible. But on the other hand, it's best to cover with whatever you have, however you can do it. I mean, there's an absolute, okay, this is what we like to see way of doing this. But then there's also, you know, okay, I've got some old sheets, I'm just going to go out and cover. That's the most important thing. But then finally, you also need to be making some plans, obviously, that if you have something that's very sensitive, you know, you need to be thinking about how long do you want to cover, and then what's the next plan? Because we've been very lucky so far. Now, I'm not sure, at least where I am in southern Butler County, we really did not have frost this morning, although it was predicted. Maybe some of the lower valley areas saw frost, but I think we've been pretty lucky so far. But if we get into frost, then a few days without it, then frost, then a few days without it, that can really present a challenge. So again, you know, at some point you decide, all right, if what I'm protecting, I'm finished with the season, then, you know, make your plans to move on.
And Sarah, we should know, because we did hear rumblings of possible frost coming this morning. It is the season for moving houseplants indoors.
Absolutely. And so when we're, and in fact, I moved all mine in yesterday. I'm not always the best horticulturalist mom, because I'm like, just one more day outside. It will be fine. You know, my daughter's okay without shoes on. It's fine. You know, kind of one of those, So yes, I did bring all my plants in. So, and what I mean by that is the tropical plants that don't do well in our cooler climates. So typically what I like to say, if we have temperatures below 45 degrees, this is just a general rule of thumb, you want to transition those indoors. Now, as soon as I do that, I brought them indoors and I literally sit them in my bathtub and I give them a nice shower and a good drink of water. That because of the insects that have been in there, spider webs, things like that, that I'm trying not to invite into my home either. So did that last night, found good places in my house, got the saucers out, all that good jazz. Now, as soon as I do that, you know, here in the next few days, there might be temperatures in the 60s. Or there might be evening temperatures above the 45 degrees. But you know what? For me, I like to, if it's consistently those temperatures, I will transition my plants back outside, those that I can lift up and move pretty easily. Because it is better for the plant to slowly transition to its new environment. So if possible, that is the best way to do it. As Joe kind of mentioned earlier, sometimes you can't always do what textbooks tell you to do. I do my best with that. But yeah, I think we're in that phase now where it doesn't look like we're going to be getting above that 45 degrees. So as far as covering other plants, plants are, you know, out in our landscape, they're going into dormancy, as we call it, and going to sleep, hibernating, if you will. And so the leaves will start to drop off. A lot of times, the most important time we have to cover our ornamental landscape plants is in the spring when buds are starting to swell and open up, and then we get that late April frost or freeze. So I had a few questions yesterday about that. The only ones I traditionally suggest covering are our tropical plants if you just want to give them one more day out there.
Yep.
All right. Well, Donna, I hope that was helpful for you.
Very much. And you settled a disagreement, so thank you.
Perfect. Thanks for the call. We're always happy to side with our callers. All right, 513-419-7100. Fred is up next before we take this break. Go ahead, Fred. What's your question?
Hi, I'm a home gardener of many decades, and I've, for the first time ever, had problems with sweet pepper plants. Some of them, not all of them, that just totally, suddenly, overnight, absolutely wilted and would not come back at all. And one of them, the first time it happened was in late June after we'd had weeks of above normal rain. So I thought, well, maybe too much rain. Why, you know? And the second time it happened was in August after we'd had weeks of virtually no rain. And the third time it happened was in late September. And it's always the same thing. I can't water them and get them to come back. They're just gone overnight.
And so are you just looking for a reason why this might be happening?
Yeah, and ultimately, what can I do to prevent it, if anything?
Okay, well, let me place you on hold. And it's another call about peppers today, this time sweet peppers rather than habanero, which we heard earlier. Joe, is this something you want to take? Fred's having trouble with these sweet pepper plants, particularly after a dry spell and then a wet spell, and wants to know what he can do.
Well, you know, I want to go back to what Sarah said earlier, and this is a really nice foundation when she mentioned that that peppers and tomatoes and eggplants and potatoes all belong to the same family, Solanaceae, so solanaceous plants. And what Fred is describing sounds pretty classic for a vascular wilt disease. And peppers and tomatoes and eggplants can be pretty susceptible to a disease called verticillium wilt. Now, if you buy plants and you look at tomatoes, for example, you may see some letters on the tag like V, T, F, F1. That's for Fusarium, which can present some similar symptoms. But it sounds like, you know, when we see these plants collapsing and not coming back, it is likely that's the problem. And here is usually how it unfolds. We always recommend that you do not plant solanaceous plants in the same spot Sarah, I mean, sometimes we hear every 2 to 3 years. I actually try to get people to alternate every year. If you've had a location where you've had tomatoes, particularly if they're tomatoes that might be heirlooms, which we all love. However, many of the heirlooms have no resistance to these diseases. So if you've had tomatoes in a spot and you think, okay, I'm going to plant something different there, well, don't plant peppers in that spot or vice versa. Don't plant eggplants in that spot or potatoes. Try to keep the solanaceous plants moving around in your garden, and that way you won't build the pathogen up in the soil. And of course, the very final thing that, you know, that I know this is one that can stare us in the face. And Sarah, I've heard you talk about this before. We always need to mention it, you know, the possibility of a black walnut tree being somewhere near at hand. Typically, we don't position gardens where you're under a black walnut, but the root system can travel great distances. And the solanaceous plants are extremely sensitive to the compound that's released from black walnut roots called juglones. And so that's always something, too, that you need to consider. You didn't mention it, and usually people that have that problem are somewhat aware. But for others listening, the wilt caused by juglones can mimic vascular wilt diseases produced by various pathogens.
And, Fred, I hope that was helpful for you. Do you have anything else about it?
They were different cultivars of peppers, and it only affected about half of my total plants. But it sounds like it's something in the soil.
Well, maybe move those around, and maybe next season give us a call back. We'd be anxious to hear how it goes. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks for the call, Fred. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. We continue with our monthly gardening show, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. You can also email talk@wvxu.org. We're joined by experts, Campbell County Extension Office Agent Sarah Imbus and Hamilton County Extension Office Agent Joe Boggs. We do have some emails to get to from listeners who have questions. We'll start with Uday, who says, "We are bringing plants inside to overwinter. How do we avoid the infestation of small black fungus gnats? We were told a layer of sand would help. Anything else?" Sarah, this is something you just did. So can you help Uday here?
Yeah, and as Joe being the bug expert can maybe chime in a little bit too. But, you know, like I said, I like to give my plants a shower. And what I mean by that, literally putting it in the bathtub and not only on the top of the foliage, but looking underneath, because a lot of our insects like to stay underneath and kind of be protected underneath there. Always making sure that your container has a drainage hole, at least one. And keep in mind, wherever you place that, on a piece of furniture, on a plant stand, you will need a saucer to collect that that water when you do water. And keep in mind, water thoroughly. So making sure that the water goes all the way through the container to moisten that soil evenly. And then, take that saucer and remove any water that is collected. And as far as those gnats, they do like moist soil. So not only those little guys, but other insects too, and just the overall plant health care of your house plant. But you kind of want a happy medium of a moisture level. So just keep that in mind. And every house temperature and environment is different as far as, well, how often do I water? And it depends on a few other factors too, but those are a few quick tips, Joe.
Yeah. The connection to moisture is extremely important. The layering of sand, that really won't do much. In fact, it could make matters worse because, that could interfere with the potting soil drying out. You're capping it over. You might think, well, it's sand, so, you know, water can move through sand easily. Well, not up. It will not wick up water, so it will cap it off, make matters worse. Typically, when we have outdoor plants that have become infested with fungus gnats, or not outdoor, but potted plants outdoors, you know, it's just a naturally occurring thing. They were getting rainfall and a little bit more water than was needed, and the fungus gnats are out there. They're part of our environment, so they came along, laid eggs, and things got started. typically, once you move them inside, as long as you're following what Sarah, her sage advice relative to letting things dry down, I mean really dry down. Typically, speaking for myself, I can tell you it's easy to overwater houseplants. You think, well, I haven't watered for a week. It's got to be dry. Put your finger in the pot. It needs to be dry. And then cycle the water, then water, and then let it go back. Fungus gnats will not take that. The immature stages, which are maggots, will not take dry soils at all. And they typically then disappear rather quickly. If, on the other hand, this is an ongoing thing, you've had a month of these fungus gnats flying around and you're thinking, you know, this is, you may want to also do a little exploratory digging, because if you've had houseplants that have started suffering from root rots, now normally you'll see that at the top, the plants will start wilting, they'll be looking bad, but any type of a fungal rotting tissue will also support fungus gnats. So if they continue to go on, you may have a problem with the root system. On the other hand, if that's not the issue, you can buy a product called Natrol, G-N-A-T-R-O-L. I think that's how it's spelled. I hope I spelled that right. But that's based on a naturally occurring bacterium. Many listeners are probably familiar with this. It's called Bacillus thuringiensis. And it's a very specific variant called Israeliensis. So BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, Israeliensis. The product is Natrol, and it is actually designed and made for killing the fungus gnat larvae. It's, again, naturally occurring bacterium. Works pretty darn well. May be hard to find. You may have to order it. But hold that off until you've done these other things. Because, again, very often the problem solves itself as long as you're not overwatering.
All right, Uday. Good luck with those black fungus gnats. I hope this advice was good for you. An email from Kathy says, quote, I have large gardens and lots of dahlias. I was looking forward to killing frost last night so that I could begin the process of digging my dahlias. But alas, although it got to 33 in my area of the region, Oxford, there was no killing frost. As I look out over the next 2 weeks, it does not appear that we have much of a chance of a killing frost. So in my mind, we are becoming further entrenched in Zone 6. Opinions? Now, I have to confess, I'm not sure what Zone 6 means.
Well,
Sarah, do you want to take it? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a good one.
It is a good one. So, zones, there's hardiness zones. There's a map and that helps us understand different temperatures of different parts of the United States and throughout the world that will thrive in the lowest temperature, like a winter hardiness temperature. So here in the Northern Kentucky area, we are about a 6.6B. When I lived in Louisville, I was a 7, so I could grow some plants there that I can no longer grow here. So of course, if you live in Florida, those plants can be grown there all year round. They would not have a hardiness zone that, would be hardy for this area. So, as far as, you know, our hardiness zones changing, I too agree with that. Keeping some political, you know, thoughts aside, but is looking at Mother Nature and what she is showing us with different plants able to be grown in these areas, insects having multiple generations a year, different fungal pathogens able to survive. So to me, yes, that is telling me there is a change. Not only atmospheric temperatures, but if you take any soil temperatures, because there is a difference, that is also has been changing. I don't have that data in front of me, but it is very interesting what Mother Nature teaches us, if you just kind of pay attention to that. So I don't think I can predict what it will be. But what I do know is that we were a 6, now we're a 6B. Now, could we move to a 7 in 15, 20 years? I would say there's a possibility. That's my 2 cents on that, Joe.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I just realized, Sarah, I've been at this long enough to have experienced a shift in the USDA plant hardiness zone maps. When I first started, much of Ohio was actually in the 5 category, and of course, and it was based on very hard data, very good data. But shortly after I started, there was a reissue of the USDA plant hardiness zone map that shifted everything north, a little bit. And I suspect that's still going to go on. I mean, I don't see any reason to think otherwise until we can get a handle on how to slow the progression. But I think that being entrenched in 6, most definitely. And as a matter of fact, again, as Sarah's pointed out, just looking at insects, a good example, I won't go too long on this, is that when I started, bagworm caterpillars, these little things that make little cone-like structures that have a caterpillar in it, bagworms, they were very rare. They rarely occurred in Ohio north of Interstate 70. So if you Interstate 70, transects the state east-west, and we just didn't see them north of 70. That has utterly changed. As a matter of fact, they've become a real issue in Michigan, where people did not grow up with them. So that insect, as an example, it does have a low temperature threshold for overwintering, and it has, and it's most definitely shifted. So we've seen this, and I think, Sarah, I think you and I refer to it as global worming, right? That's an awful joke.
Boggs, I love it.
But I couldn't help it.
No, we love silly puns here.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, I hope that was a really good question from Kathy, and I think I certainly learned a lot from the responses, and I hope that Kathy got an interesting perspective as well. We're up against another break coming up, but let's get through a few more emails here. One came in from Jason in Blue Ash that says, how to eliminate scary bush honeysuckle and what is the best item to plant in its place? He says, I have a large vacant lot in Northside that I would like to use as a large garden, but there is much honeysuckle. Sarah?
Yeah, I feel like this is one next to bamboo that we talk about quite often. And I am very happy to hear that people are interested in the removal of honeysuckle. It actually, not only above ground that it's, it's a nuisance, but also below ground, it actually has a natural compound that it's like an herbicide, a natural herbicide that the plant creates. So it prevents other plants from growing around it, kind of choking them out so that the honeysuckle can thrive. But removing it can be a challenge. I will say it's an ongoing challenge, maybe a few years, depending upon the maturity of which you see right now. But once it defoliates, I think is the best time to get in there and start removing it. If you can use a tool to remove its whole root structure, that is ideal. Though if they're too large of a caliper, chainsaw it down as close as you can to the soil surface and use a concentrated non-selective herbicide and paintbrush it directly on there. You might have to reapply that in the spring, you'll have a greater success, I believe, if you start doing that. I did some removal when I was at the University of Kentucky Arboretum in Lexington, and it is amazing. In 1 year, we did this project fall and winter, and then that next spring, all the wildflowers that had been dormant there for so long came back. And I mean, that was a magic show for me to see how Mother Nature can sit and wait for then those trilliums and those other wildflowers that can then receive the sunlight and germinate and thrive again. That is my best, I guess, in my experience. There are other methods, of course. My favorite tool, the blowtorch.
Yes, finally. Let's get it out.
That probably will not do much just because it's its root structure. The blowtorch is usually more of those noxious weeds in between, you know, the walkways and maybe in some of your landscape beds. But it is very challenging, but I really appreciate as far as going back in with something, because that is super important. You want to go back and provide Mother Nature with some plant material. So we have tons of information, extensions, and so does the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanic Garden. But one thing that comes to mind, not only planting shrubs, but maybe diversifying what you're planting. So making sure that you provide habitat for birds, a food source, and all that other good jazz and color. But also our fall interest, our winter interest. So if you need, I always suggest going in with that two or three different types of plants into a landscape, especially when you're, I can only imagine, eradicating honeysuckle, it's probably a large space. So it'll be ideal if you can go in to diversify that space. And I am more than happy to share a few suggestions. If you can send me a picture of this space, I can help direct you with more plant selection.
Yeah, Jason, be sure to check out Sarah Imbus at the Campbell County Extension Office and send a photo of your space in Northside. Perhaps she can help you further. Thanks so much for that email. I've got one more we can get in before the break here. We've got phone line open at 513-419-7100 if you're interested in joining our conversation. We got an email from Donna, says, I've set up a cold frame in my yard. What sort of crops should I consider growing over the winter months other than spinach and lettuces? Joe, is that something you can help with?
Well, and I want to go back to something you say. Well, you know, even though the blowtorch may not be very effective on the honeysuckles, it's very satisfying, isn't it, Sarah? I mean, you know, at least you're...
We should take the blowtorch to some pumpkins this weekend once they're out of season, just to blow off some steam.
Oh, man.
So cold frames are just wonderful things. And I always direct people towards thinking about the cold crops. You know, you can do a lot of things in cold frames using vegetables, using plants that we tend to think of as being fall plants, you know. And they do quite well. I mean, I know individuals who harvest throughout the winter with cold frames. And I, you know, you mentioned, I think she mentioned lettuce, but also, you know, broccoli, things like that can do very well. If you like kale. Now, the downside to those cold crops is you don't want them to get too hot. So even in January, with a cold frame shut down and light coming in, you do need to monitor the temperature because it can get very hot in those. And some of my friends have had cold frames have actually had damage because they allowed things to get too hot in the winter. Other perspectives, Sarah? I mean, I'm just kind of flying across the surface on this.
Yeah, and not only can you use cold frames this time of year, but also late winter, early spring to get a jump start on your plants.
Yes.
So Okay. Starting plants in that cold frame, but the same thing, it is its own little ecosystem. So those temperatures, it is a great resource. And I've seen some folks, I've never personally done this, but creating a cold frame for some of their house plants, their tropical plants, keeping those in, you know, outdoors and keeping.
Wow.
Yes, because it does stay warm. But again, mm-hmm. I've never tried that because I enjoy those looking at those inside my house.
Well, we've got to get a break in. You want to share a last thought?
Yep. No, they're just a great resource or a great tool, and we have plenty of resources if you're interested.
Yeah, cool. All right, Donna, thank you for emailing us. We appreciate it. We'll get back to emails and phone calls on the other side of this break. You're listening to our monthly gardening show on Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. It's our monthly gardening show. We are joined by Campbell County Extension Office Agent Sarah Embus and Hamilton County Extension Office Agent Joe Boggs. And I want to let you know, if you're listening, I am going to bring up cicadas momentarily, but it's not my fault. It's Joe's fault. And we're going to hear a little bit about why they are the gift that keeps giving momentarily. So let's move through a phone call and an email really quick. We'll start with Devin, who joins us on the phone. Hi, Devin. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I have a mother-in-law's tongue plant in a pot on my porch that I just brought in this morning, and I'm noticing it needs to be repotted, if not split, because it's kind of too big for its pot. I'm wondering if bringing that in and dividing it is a good idea right now, or if that should wait for a while.
All right, let me place you on hold, Devin. Again, Sarah, you just went through this, bringing your plants inside. This is a mother-in-law's tongue that Devin has brought in and needs a new pot and is wondering if it can be split at this time.
Yeah, so snake plant is another common name for that plant. They kind of like to be a little pot bound, but if it's getting a little top heavy where it seems unbalanced, then yes, it is time to probably move it into maybe even a taller or little wider. But keep in mind, it does like to be a little pot bound, meaning it likes to be snugged in its little pot. Okay. Ideally, a lot of our repotting can be done in the spring, but you know, I too, just recently had to repot something that was a little top heavy because it grew happily this past spring and summer outdoors, and I did not pay attention to that. So it's not going to hurt it at all. That's actually a tough plant. Just making sure that whichever container you do choose, it has a drainage hole. That would be ideal. Unfortunately, a lot of our pots, pretty pots, I should say, that we may purchase, they do not have drainage holes. And so I would encourage you to drill those out, or some of them actually already have like an indented area where you'll have to take a tool such as a screwdriver, for example, and pierce those out. So just keep that in mind. And then as far as using potting soil, make sure that it is potting soil, not garden soil. And I've said it before and I'll say it again, I like to spend my most money in my soil followed by my pot. I don't know, they might even be right there in line of the same. So good quality soil, again, potting soil, and you'll have a great success.
There you go, Devin. We hope that was helpful for you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You got it. Thanks for the call. And very quickly, let's get an answer to this email so that we can talk about cicadas on the other side of it. Monica writes in and says, we have been transitioning our park in Dayton's Oregon Historic District to native plants. Last spring, with support from the Dayton Foundation, Siebenthaler's Garden Center, and contributions from neighbors, we removed a dying conifer and replaced it with a wonderful large bur oak. We kept it watered through the summer. However, in the past few weeks, the tree has not been thriving. An arborist thinks the tree has phytophthora, which is fatal, and also, before we replant, the arborist recommends removing the tree and taking out the soil. So Monica wants to know, do you have any recommendations on how to save the tree and tackle
Phytophthora.
Say it again.
Yeah.
Say it again.
Phytophthora.
Okay, I'm adding syllables and letters that aren't there.
It's a difficult name. I would actually... if it was recently planted, it's probably unlikely that Phytophthora is occurring. That's a water mold. It tends to take quite some time for it to become pathogenic. However, if there's a suspicion of there being a root rot pathogen, and that's where Phytophthora fits into the picture, then it typically is associated with too much water. And so sometimes on newly planted trees, we always need to be careful not to kill them with kindness. Now, I'm not saying this is what happened necessarily, but it's something you do need to examine. I don't think, if it was just planted this year, I think I would probably let it go through the winter and then assess it in the spring. If it's truly collapsing, you'll know very early in the spring if there is an issue. It could simply be, if it was planted this year, it could simply be I don't want to go so far as transplant shock, but there is such a thing. But it could just be still trying to establish. Bur oaks can sometimes take a bit of time to establish. particularly if it was a B&B tree or even containerized trees. So I think I would just give it a little, I'd give it this winter, give it next spring and assess it then. I would never, ever do a Phytophthora diagnosis without sending a sample to our clinic, the clinic in Ohio, the Plant and Pest Diagnostic Clinic. For listeners in Kentucky, fantastic clinic down at UK, same idea. And that would confirm if there's a pathogen because we can't be sure until that's done.
And there you go, Monica. Good luck. I look forward to visiting the Oregon District again very, very soon.
That's a wonderful place, isn't it?
Oh, yes, it is.
Yeah.
And very quickly, Rich from the Ohio River Foundation wanted to just weigh in on the honeysuckle removal and says, look out for the Ohio River Valley Cooperative for Invasive Species Management Area. This is a coalition of 14 agencies working in a 22-county area around Cincinnati. You can search for that, Ohio River Valley Cooperative, online and find more details on invasive species like honeysuckle and how to combat them. We've only got a couple of minutes left, and I have to revisit cicadas, Joe, because you know how terrified I was during cicada season here in the Cincinnati area. They did me dirty, frankly. They broke my car. I had a crash. I had to get a new axle put on the car.
Oh, my goodness.
It was not good. But you're telling me that this is the gift that keeps on giving. What are we seeing the cicadas do for us now that they're gone?
Well, they've been gone a long time, but their damage, the oviposition damage, where they inserted eggs into the twigs, didn't always cause those twigs to break and drop. Particularly on red oaks, it causes what we call flagging. So the tips of the branches, the leaves have turned brown, and they're very apparent. They're still out there. On the other hand, if you're seeing tips of twigs that are green dropping from the tree, you may want to take a look at our little furry friends, because right now gray squirrels are doing this thing where they lop off the tips of the branches. There's a lot of suspicions as to why they do that. One might be that they're going after acorns on twig sizes of twigs that wouldn't hold their weight. They just simply lop them off, and then they go to the ground to harvest them. So, the cicadas just keep giving. And by the way, that damage could be apparent even next season. So don't get too excited. Take a good close look at it. It'll look like somebody ran a sewing machine up and down the twig. And that's just the periodical cicada damage.
Well, thankfully, we don't have to deal with them in person again for many, many years. So, of course, we all hope to be around to see them again next time. But look, Joe has a wonderful blog that he writes a lot of informative articles, and I couldn't get to them all today, but it's called The Buckeye Yard and Garden Online. It's part of the Ohio State Extension Program. So I would just tell you to search for Buckeye Yard and Garden Online and find a lot of his writings. It's pretty frequently updated with a lot of cool stuff. Sarah Embis from the Campbell County Extension Office. Check out their website too, because they are always full of great tips and information related to this stuff. I couldn't get to all the emails today. So Joe, Sarah, look in your inbox. I'm going to forward these to you. So if you all did send an email, we didn't get to it on air. Sarah and Joe are always kind, along with all of our other gardening experts, to respond after hours to your questions. So I appreciate that. Joe, Sarah, thanks for a fun gardening show today. Happy Halloween, and hopefully we'll talk again before Thanksgiving. We can talk about pumpkin pie again.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that would be great.
All right. Talk to you all.
Take care, Michael and Sarah.
You got it. Talk to you both soon. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Producer Selena Reeder, assistant producer Nick Swartzel, technical director Josh Elstro. The website is wvxu.org. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again tomorrow.